Thank you for coming here today, and it's a real honor to have been invited, and I really appreciate having this opportunity. If I can also just do a little bit of advertising, I'll also say that I have a forthcoming book that should be out sometime this year, 2017 that is, called something like Disappointments, Critical Hermeneutic Essays on World Building. So that might be of interest, or it might not, depending on how you react to this paper. But this is not something that comes from that book, but it is something that I'm working on another book that's a much more ethnographic book of what I call the anti-drug war movement. And this is political activists spread out all around the globe who are fighting in various ways against the drug war. And if I'm not speaking loud enough, please tell me. Good. So this is still a work in progress to some extent, so I really hope you'll feel free to help me make it better. So I'll start with a quote. "It's a war on people. It's a war on communities. It's a war on entire segments of cities. This is how a New York City anti-drug war agonist once described the drug war to me, and how it is understood and articulated by innumerable other such agonists around the globe. And I tend to use the term agonist instead of political activist, because I really want to emphasize the agonistic, struggling aspect of doing politics. When representatives of governments, states, and international institutions speak of the drug war, they speak as though it is a quasi-metaphorical description of the benevolent attempt on their part to protect national and global populations from apparently dangerous substances. This rhetoric suggests that the war is waged on these substances, and this, along with the medicalization of the disease model of addiction and its therapeutic treatment, results in the contemporary dominant discourse of the war on drugs as protective policies more akin to public health initiatives than any actually fought war. When on occasion the drug war is articulated as an actual war, the enemy is, for the most part, officially marked as the dealers, the cartels, and the bad guys that threaten communities. Populations in this narrative must be protected." This is not how the global anti-drug war movement understands the drug war, and it is not how innumerable drug users around the globe experience it. For them, it is indeed a war on people. This war, as far as they can tell, does not protect a population as much as it creates a particular kind of population. For it is only by means of the discursive, structural, and physical violence enacted against certain kinds of people, in this case, drug users, that a protectable population comes into being. Put another way, a protectable population never exists prior to the enactment of a biopolitical will that creates that population through acts of exclusionary force against another and covers over that force with a rhetorical discourse of security. First declared in 1971 by Richard Nixon, the war on drugs has become a highly militarized, punitive, exceedingly expensive international war on people waged to some extent by nearly every country on the globe. With the U.S. federal government having spent over $1 trillion since its inception, and all the countries on the globe spending well over $100 billion annually, the result of the drug war seems to be little more than the violent consumption of drug user lives. From the mass incarceration of a significant proportion of a generation of African-American men in the United States to the street battles, assassinations, and collateral damage that has led to over 70,000 deaths in Mexico since 2006, from the torturous rehabilitation conditions found throughout Russia to the extrajudicial killings by the military and police in 2003 of at least 2,300 suspected drug offenders in Thailand, a phenomenon, it should be noted, that is being repeated at this very moment in the Philippines, to the preventable health risks users and non-users are exposed to everywhere as the result of stigmatization and lack of harm reduction programs, the drug war seemingly has resulted in little more than the death, suffering, and abjection of millions of users and non-users alike. Indeed, the 200,000 annual drug war deaths equal approximately 3/5 of the total deaths in the so-called war on terror since 2001. In other words, as it is well put by a Canadian anti-drug war organization, the drug war as a war on people provides the conditions within which people who use drugs become expendable beings. Meanwhile, drug cartels continue to accumulate wealth and power that in some instances far surpasses that of sovereign nations, and states increasingly tighten security and surveillance that impacts the lives of entire populations. Indeed, much of the police violence, racial profiling, and the personal and structural consequences of mass incarceration that have recently received significant political and media attention is directly intertwined with the drug war. For example, since Nixon declared the war on drugs, the prison population in the United States has skyrocketed. In 1972, there were approximately 300,000 people incarcerated in the United States. Today, there are approximately 2.3 million. As Byron Stevenson puts it, drug policy and the incarceration of low-level drug offenders, and it should be noted, 40% of all drug arrests in the United States are for simple marijuana possession or personal use possession. So these low-level drug offenders is the primary cause of mass incarceration in the United States. There's a jumbled quote, sorry about that. And this spends about $68 billion annually, and the U.S. spends about $68 billion annually on incarceration. The United States has become so adept at incarcerating its population that today 1 in 31 adults is either in jail, prison, or on probation or parole. And since 60% of the U.S. prison population is a non-white minority, this new carceral society, or what anti-drug war agonists call the drug war gulag, has overwhelmingly affected African-American and Latino-American communities. But the carceral society does not end at the American borders. For worldwide, over 10 million people are incarcerated, an all-time high that Stevenson claims is primarily the result of the drug war. Increasingly, social and political theorists consider our contemporary condition one of war. For example, Giorgio Agamben has characterized our contemporary political paradigm as that of civil war. And Michael Hart and Antonio Negri perhaps provide the most sustained theoretical analysis of how this is so. Yet the primary example utilized in both cases is the war on terror. I agree with these and other thinkers who argue for this global condition of war. But if we want to understand what war as a form of governance entails, then we must go beyond analyses of the war on terror, counterinsurgency, or other forms of perpetual war between and within nation states and those groups that seek to overthrow or harass them. The drug war illustrates well that in the contemporary condition of things, war as governance is primarily a war on people fought potentially anywhere and against anyone. If we want to understand this contemporary condition of war, then we must interrogate the ways in which this war is waged against ordinary people right here in the midst of everyday life, and how these people struggle against it. This essay is an attempt to do just this. One of the fundamental assumptions of this essay, then, is that if modernity is best understood in terms of a biopolitics that has been primarily concerned with the care of populations and life, then this was only possible by means of war as an integral aspect of biopolitical governance. And although war occasionally manifests as war against an external enemy in the form of another sovereign power, war as a necessary aspect of biopolitical governance is primarily waged as wars on internal enemies, or wars on people. Because wars on people, such as the drug war, are central to biopolitical governance, it is important to recognize that those against whom these wars are waged remain perpetually bound up with the very power that wages war against them. As Judith Butler puts it, such internal enemies remain, quote, in a situation of forcible exposure to the exercise of state power freed from the constraints of all law. As such, the people against whom such wars on people are waged remain ever present as the necessary internal other that provides the validating foundation of not only the truth, but more importantly, the rightness of the biopolitical order. War, in this sense, is the general ontological condition for the contemporary order of things. Who then are the people that constitute the internal enemy? How are we to recognize that internal other if she seemingly belongs to that which we ourselves belong? As Butler convincingly argues, war itself provides us with such criteria for both recognizing and affectively relating to the internal other, even if these come by means of a general non-recognition and objection. Within the general condition of war, we become capable of recognizing who counts as the enemy, while at the same time not grieving the zones of uninhabitability within which she is left to survive. In other words, war provides the conditions for us to become the kinds of subjects who are able to recognize them as unworthy of living, because incapable of living our kind of life. That is to say, war renders the internal other an object over and against our subjectivity. War, then, provides both the subject of belonging and the ungrievable object that is inclusively excluded from, that is, grounds such belonging. In this essay, I will interrogate the discursive production of the internal enemy of the addict, whose expendability grounds the biopolitical order of things, and the way in which some of these addicts politically fight back by seeking to disrupt this order. In the following section, I will consider the discursive framing of addicts in order to ask such questions as who, or perhaps better put, what is this drug addict that stands as the internal other? What does its presence tell us about our contemporary order and its biopolitical means of securing that order's way of life? In the final section, I return to the anti-drug war movement with which I opened this essay in order to consider the ways in which drug users as an organized political movement mobilize against this war waged on them. What becomes clear is that one of the primary tactics of the anti-drug war movement is what I call a disruptive politics of showing, by which these political agonists disrupt the dehumanizing discursive practices of the drug war by performatively enacting the otherwise they hope one day will come to be, and as such, laying the grounds for the new social and political habits this otherwise would entail. This next section is called A Fantasy World of Addicts and Evil. For the last 10 years, I have been engaged in an ongoing ethnographic research project of the global anti-drug war movement. And I won't go into it here, but if any of you are interested in what this project looks like, in 2015 in the journal Cultural Anthropology, I have an article called What is a Situation? In which I try to describe not only the way in which I've been doing this research, but also try to describe the phenomenon of the drug war in terms of what I call widely diffused complexity that manifests temporarily as situations. And maybe we can get into that somewhere. But no matter where my research took me as I followed this global resistance, a key aim that I heard over and over again was the need to change the conditions or the interpretive matrix through which the drug war and its consequences are understood. This was perhaps most commonly and openly articulated in the weekly meetings of the Drug Users Union that I did research with in New York City. During the process of strategizing or planning tactics for addressing very specific problems, for example, police violence, there is also always an awareness that the ultimate aim of their work is addressing the conditions of the drug war. These conditions were most commonly referred to as the drug war culture, or ideology, or mindset, and were recognized as that which frames the ways in which most of the people they engage in their political work, and most people in general for that matter, relate to and understand drug use and drug users. Indeed, as members of the union often put it, the conditions of the drug war produce a fantasy world such that people don't live in reality, but instead in a prison of the mind. Because of this, one of the primary tasks of the anti-drug war movement is, as one of the leaders put it in a New York strategizing meeting, shattering the mindset of those who have become imprisoned by the drug war ideology. In the rest of this section, I will consider the discursive production of this fantasy world that the anti-drug war movement addresses because they understand that most people they engage with, politicians, police, medical personnel, social services, media, family members, probably many of you in this room, and nearly everyone else, most of these people relate to and understand drug use and users through the conditions that produce this fantasy world. What I want to emphasize, however, is that despite the fact that anti-drug war agonists speak of a fantasy world, the worlds in which they live are not at all fantasy, but very real indeed. The conditions of the drug war have not covered over some true reality with a false fantasy, but rather have produced reality itself, no matter how absurd it may be. After considering the discursive production of this fantasy world, in the final section of the essay, I turn to one of the most significant tactics utilized by the anti-drug war movement in their attempt to shatter mindsets. As will become clear, what I call the hermeneutically disruptive political tactic of the anti-drug war movement does not disclose a true reality, but rather disrupts the drug war fantasy world in order to create possibilities for other, more open and non-exclusionary worlds to come into existence. Evil addicts. With 184 parties to it, the United Nations 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs established the now international norm of scheduling drugs and the criminalization of drug use. As a result, the Single Convention provides the framework within which the domestic drug policies of all signatories and parties are made and the drug war is waged. But this document not only established the criminalization of drug users as the global norm, it also provides the institutional grounds for their dehumanization. Thus, the preamble of the Single Convention states that addiction is, quote, a serious evil for the individual and is fraught with social and economic danger to mankind, and that it is the duty of all parties to prevent and combat this evil, end quote. Here, with this institutional grounding of what would become the global war on drugs, we have the question, we have the equation of addiction with an evil that poses a threat to the very social existence, that is, the social and economic order of mankind. As is always the case with evil, that enemy of good and order, humankind, so it is made clear, has a duty to combat it. Thus, the drug war is institutionally framed as a call to fight evil. But if addiction is the evil to be fought, it must be remembered that addiction is always embodied. With addiction, there is always an addict. So then, what is the addict? To begin to answer this question, and in so doing, get a glimpse at the way in which the drug war discursively frames addicts as less than human, I will consider at length an online CNN article entitled Addicts Shoot Up in a Safe Haven in Canada, which is a companion piece to Shooting Up Legally, a CNN International World's Untold Stories special report about Insight, the supervised injection facility in the downtown east side of Vancouver. And this is one of the places where I did a lot of research for this project. Because this article is positioned as upholding so-called journalistic standards of neutrality and objectivity in its investigation of Insight and the downtown east side of Vancouver in general, analyzing its discursive framing allows us to see more clearly the reproduction of the drug war fantasy world than would an analysis of an article with more obviously discriminatory and exclusionary language. For in contrast to such obvious discriminatory media depictions as the Irish Independence sterilizing junkies may seem harsh, but it does make sense, or the innumerable other such articles in which drug users are insulted and demeaned with a large degree of impunity, this CNN article makes an attempt to fairly portray the conditions in which drug users try to survive the war waged against them. While both the online article and the television special certainly maintain CNN's typical attempt to give both sides of the story, they nevertheless perpetuate the conditions by which drug users are rendered as those internal others who are not like us because they are in significant ways less than human. Thus, already in the title of the article, the subjects of this story are depicted as such. That is, as addicts. From the Latin addictus, meaning variously assigned by decree, bound, to surrender, to enslave, or to condemn, an addict is one who has become enslaved or bound to a substance, an activity, or in some cases a person. An addict, as enslaved, has lost control of himself, no longer possesses sufficient will to free himself from his bondage, and in fact only desires that to which he is already enslaved. And as enslaved, relinquishes any responsibility for his actions to himself or others in the sole pursuit of that to which he is bonded. The attic, then, has lost all of the qualities, rational and moral, that today have come to define humanness. The article's first lines immediately set the frame for the non-humanity of the drug-using addict. Quote, heroin, cocaine, and amphetamines are the kind of street drugs you expect to find in the shady corners of any city, hiding away from the glare of law enforcement. But in one small space in downtown Vancouver, addicts openly inject their fixes as medics watch on, end quote. We expect, the article assumes, to find these illicit and dangerous substances in the dark shadows of cities, alleyways, under bridges, behind dumpsters. This is, after all, where the abject of cities tend to gather. Note that what gathers in these shady corners, however, are the substances, the heroin, cocaine, and amphetamines, and the reader is left to assume that the unsaid accompaniment of these substances are the addicts that are bound to them. The redundancy, apparently, would be unnecessary. For as with the slave or servant who is simply identified by the name of its owner or lord, the addict who has surrendered herself to a substance is identified with it. The addict as enslaved has become consubstantial with the drug. The addict has become abject. Indeed, the second sentence confirms this reading, as only here the addict appears openly in order to be watched, as if only under the surveillance of biopolitically trained medics can the addict recover a part of her humanity. But this partial recovery is only momentary, for here, under the watchful and responsible eye of the medic, the unsaid, consubstantial being of addict and substance in the first sentence is reiterated in the second, as addicts openly inject their fixes, and so, in their very openness, come to embody the conditions of their being. Thus, despite the author's attempt to write an objective journalistic piece, the limits are already in place for how the reader should understand the subject of the article. The addict is less than human. This assumption of the less than human nature of the drug user continues throughout the article, articulated in different voices. For example, the author herself continues to use the term addict throughout the entire article, and in one particularly telling line in describing insight and what happens there, she discloses the less than human qualities of the addict. With fluorescent lighting and lots of mirrors, the atmosphere is clinical. Even as the room fills with drug addicts focused on one task only, feeding their addiction, unquote. Like popular images of primitive man who spent all of his time doing nothing other than desperately trying to find enough food to make it through the day, so too addicts have only one focus, feeding their addiction. Without will and seemingly incapable of self-control or responsibility, the addict can only focus on his singular desire, his insatiable need for more drugs. More primitive than civilized, more animal than human, the addict cannot help himself, even in the most modern and civilized of atmospheres, the clinical setting. Indeed, the second voice of the article, the voice that apparently lends the objectivity to the piece and provides the other side of the story, the voice of David Berner, an addiction counselor and founder of Canada's first residential treatment center, gives expert support to this depiction of drug users. He asks sarcastically, is it more humane to help a person stay stupid? To help a person stay enslaved? You don't need to have heroin or needles or crack pipe kits to entice people to health. You could approach people and say, let me look at that sore. I'm a nurse. Let's clean you up a bit, end quote. Clearly opposed to insight in any harm reduction model at all, Mr. Berner tells us that the humane thing to do, one could say the enlightened thing to do, is to help free the slaves from his self-imposed ignorance. Like the child who brings the alley cat home to mother, Berner seems to be saying that all a drug user really needs is a bit of care, a bath, and a good home to domesticate him. Whether in Vancouver, New York City, St. Petersburg, Copenhagen, Den Passer, or anywhere else I have done research with active drug users, I have never met one who doesn't want care, a bath, and a home. But I've never met one who wants them because he thinks she is stupid, a slave, or less than human. Berner's paternalistic view of what drug users need, however, depicts them as not counting as human and only worthy of that name once they are cleaned up a bit through a therapeutic intervention. The polysemy of the word clean does a good bit of the work here, as it refers most explicitly to the cleaning of the sewer, but also to the cleaning of the body, is that which on the interior, on the exterior, may be dirty from living on the street, as well as cleansing the body as a whole, and not to mention the body politic, from drugs. Only a fully clean being, so it seems, can be a human being. The third voice in the article, however, wants to remind readers that there is more to this being that we call human than cleanliness. Liana, a resident of the downtown East Side, who has been using drugs for 20 years, told the author, "Remember us addicts, we're somebody's mother, we're somebody's sister, we're somebody's daughter." Although Liana uses the word addict to describe herself, and indeed, unfortunately, it is too often the case that users continue to describe and understand themselves in the terms made available within the conditions of the drug war, she also reminds us that she and her fellow users are in fact just as human as non-users. And this is particularly emphasized by referencing the discursively dominant notion of the gendered, familial, and reproductive dimension of humanness. In fact, the author attempts to emphasize the humanness of Liana when she first introduces her in the article. Quote, "In the alleys we meet Liana, another long-term user, who has used Insight since it opened in 2003. She is articulate, educated, and angry," end quote. Despite the humanizing intent, this description of Liana as articulate and educated is completely out of place in the flow of the narrative and seems to do nothing other than refer to the conditions that render and frame the drug addict as stupid and less than human. For the author feels no need to describe David Berner or any of the other politicians or social workers she quotes as articulate or educated. Apparently, the author only feels that she must inform the reader that someone who has been using drugs for 20 years and was met in an alley could also be articulate and educated. Just to be sure that we don't get the wrong picture, though, Liana is also described as angry, a passion that seems to fit our sense of those who are met in alleys. In this one CNN article, then, we see nearly the full range of the dehumanizing discourse that frames drug users as those inclusively excluded other of our biopolitical order. Thus, the drug user is framed as having lost her freedom, her autonomy, and her self-responsibility and control. She has lost her very humanity to the substance. Yet there is something more than mere slavery about this view of the addict. For if it were merely a matter of being enslaved to a substance, then one could have their freedom and thus their humanity restored by being released from this enslavement. Unfortunately, this is not how it works for many of those who are former users. Rather, for many of those who no longer use, the mark of use remains. As Terrence, one of the leaders of the New York City Users Union, once told me, "Even if I don't use anymore, it's all they want to talk about. It's all they see." Even if one becomes clean, she remains a former addict, or in the parlance of Narcotics Anonymous, always and forever a recovering addict. The suspicion remains. The question remains, is she really clean? The director of an international harm reduction and drug policy organization once described this to me as though the person who uses drugs gets contaminated by the drug, a contamination that she can never clean herself of. When the director spoke of this contamination, he was not only talking about addiction, but also about possession. The fact that the director was also here speaking of possession is important, for it suggests that perhaps neither slavery nor contamination is the best way to consider the exclusionary transformation of the drug user that the drug war produces. For as I have already pointed out, the addict can never regain her humanity. She is forever an addict, even if a former one. And even if an addict can become clean again, suggesting that she has rid herself of the impurity by which she was once contaminated, the notion of contamination suggested by the director does not help us understand how mere possession of a substance or even of paraphernalia, such as a syringe or pipes, can result in incarceration. This notion of contamination does not fully help us understand how it is that in 2011 alone, the New York City Police Department arrested 50,684 people for merely possessing personal use amounts of marijuana. The dehumanization that is produced by the drug war, then, cannot be thought simply in terms of slavery as loss of control or sovereignty, and neither can it be thought in terms of the purity and danger of contamination. Rather, as revealed in the very first line of the CNN article, this dehumanization is best conceived in terms of a transformation of ontological status, a dehumanization as the transformation of the human subject into a non-human object, whereby the user and the drug become one through a process of consubstantiality. Consubstantialis is a Latin rendering of the Greek homoousios, both of which can be translated as of one being or of the same being, and is the concept used in the Nicene Creed to describe Christ as being of the same being as God the Father. It is this consubstantiality of the Father and Son that at one and the same time render them separate and distinct entities and of the same being, and thus providing the ontological ground for the Trinitarian God. Similarly, I'm trying to argue that the conditions of the drug war render the user and the drug consubstantial. Recall the opening line of the CNN article, quote, "Heroin, cocaine, and amphetamines are the kind of street drugs you expect to find in the shady corners of any city, hiding away from the glare of law enforcement. But in one small space in downtown Vancouver, addicts openly inject their fixes as medics watch on," unquote. The substances of the first sentence and the addicts of the second are linked in a relation of consubstantiality, separate and distinct entities, and yet of the same being. Whether in the sentences or in our worlds, the substances and the addicts could be interchanged and it would not alter their sense. But unlike the sharedness of being that grounds the Christian God, the result of the consubstantiality of user and drug is not divine, but rather evil. It is through this ontological transformation by which drug users are rendered consubstantial with the substances they use that the drug war produces the other, internal to humanness itself. This then suggests that the addict is not so much enslaved to a drug as much as bound to it, bound being one of the other meanings of addictus, bound, that is, consubstantially as of the same being. The result is the dehumanization of a certain vector of humanness. The consubstantiality of the addict and the drug is understood, as the single convention put it, as an evil that displaces the essential goodness of she who has been transformed. As evil, or the absence of good, the addict is the ultimate internal other, the other not only of society, but of humanness itself. Indeed, the internal enemy who, as a single convention makes clear, it is mankind's duty to combat. Having thus produced its own internal enemy, the drug war has also simultaneously produced that protectable population who must be secured. This, then, is the first inclusive exclusionary step in the drug war as a biopolitical war of governance, which has been waged by means of the various forms of violence I outlined in the first section of this essay. A disruptive politics of shelling. I have so far been tracing the discursive framing of addicts as less than human, consubstantialized with substances understood as evil threats to humanity and the order of things. In this condition of war that renders drug users non-human internal enemies, how might they begin to politically fight against this war on people? In other words, how can those who have had their very ontological status as potential political agents eviscerated, that is, their status as human beings, begin to do political activity and become recognized as doing such? In the final section of this essay, I will turn to what I call the disruptive political tactic of shelling, by which anti-drug war agonists disclose the fantasy of the fantasy world, and in so doing, simultaneously enact or show the very otherwise they hope to bring into existence. As will become clear, both the disclosure and the otherwise are enacted through a disruption of the fantasy world, and it is in the brief clearing made by this disruption that anti-drug war agonists show that other worlds are possible. What I want to suggest, then, is that in the contemporary condition in which wars on people have become central to biopolitical governance, this political tactic is the first step of political resistance through which new social and political habits and eventually other non-exclusionary worlds may become possible. I think that's just basically an old way of thinking, that users are nothing, that they're a waste, Martin told me one day as we sat around at the Union in New York City waiting for the leadership meeting to begin. That's just so not true, he continued, and that's what we do here. That's why we meet here and meet with politicians, to show them that we are not waste, that we aren't nothing. Showing is a good deal of what anti-drug war agonists do. There is, of course, much focus on such things as policy change, legislative initiatives, and addressing particular problems like syringe access or police oppression. All of this rests, however, on a disruptive politics of showing, a political tactic that primarily aims at disrupting the drug war fantasy so to open a clearing through which new conditions for being may emerge. Indeed, if conditions are that by which worlds and their inhabitants are framed and produced, then much of the work of politics must be to offer possible alternative conditions for the worlds we could live in. This is something anti-drug war agonists know well. For none of their other tactics, let alone their ultimate aim of ending the drug war, are possible without this form of disruptive politics, by which they seek to disrupt the fantasy world of the drug war and open new possibilities for other worlding conditions. It is important to emphasize the difference between this disruptive politics of showing and prefigurative politics. While the latter can be described as political activity that attempts to foreshadow or represent an imagined and hoped-for future, the disruptive politics of showing is enacted to disrupt or initiate a breakdown of the mindsets of those who inhabit and perpetuate the fantasy world of the drug war by showing them that the otherwise they cannot imagine already exists right here in front of them. This is the difference, then, between temporarily performing a political hope and doing the sustained hard work of politically building new worlds. This hermeneutically disruptive political tactic, then, is the first step in what I have elsewhere called a politics of world building. Martin described to me once the effects of this disruptive tactic. When I'm dressed for a meeting with a politician, you think I was on Wall Street until I look you in the eye and let you know I am one of those same people that I'm fighting for. Sitting across the table from you right now is an active user, and to see their jaw drop and their eyes stretch open with, "Really? Yes, that's right, and there are many more just like me." Perhaps this tactic would be better called something like shock and awe, for its ultimate immediate consequence is disruption, a shaking of one out of their habits of being, thinking, talking, and doing. It initiates what I have elsewhere called a breakdown or a dissonance that arises when a habituated normativity is confronted by its founding exclusion, thus forcing one to reflect on and alter one's already acquired way of being in the world in order to account for this confrontation. People become stupefied, Martin said another time, when he tells them that he is an active user. They really can't help but to pay attention to what I say after I tell them they are just so fascinated that this is even possible, he said. For example, at a drug policy event in Buffalo, New York, Martin had just finished giving a talk about his personal experiences with the dehumanization of the drug war when a state senator approached him. Apparently moved by what Martin had just said, the senator asked how long Martin had been clean, assuming that he was a former user. Martin answered that he had not used in about 12 hours. The senator was astonished. 12 hours? Martin replied, "Yeah, 12 hours. The senator looked at him with fascination and said, "Are you serious?" They eventually started to talk about the user's union, their aims, and the cost of the drug war. And this conversation went on for about 20 minutes. And I don't know if any of you have ever done any kind of political lobbying or meeting with lawmakers or policy people or politicians, but to be able to talk with somebody for 20 minutes, that's pretty impressive. I mean, oftentimes if you get these meetings, you're lucky if it gets to go 10 minutes. The disruption, the breakdown initiated by the simple fact of an active drug user engaged in political activity then opened a possibility for political conversation and hopefully eventually more. Henrik, the head of the users union in Copenhagen, Denmark, has also realized the political productivity of disruption and regularly uses it when meeting new agonists. Henrik has been using heroin several times a day, every day, for over 20 years. And like many heroin users, you would never know it. He looks and sounds just like any other average 50-something Danish man. He uses this to his advantage when meeting with politicians, bureaucrats, or any others with whom he meets regularly in his advocating and lobbying duties as the head of the union. As he's described it to me, and as I've witnessed on a few occasions, I'll be sitting in this meeting with them for some time, or I'll have them here at the union giving them a tour and showing them around. And after a while, I'll just stop what I'm doing and turn to them and say, oh, by the way, I'm on heroin right now. They're always so shocked. They just couldn't imagine that some junkie on heroin could be standing in front of them looking so good and sounding intelligent. It really shakes them, and they really start to listen after that. This jaw-dropping fascination and shock of New York and Danish politicians are the consequence of a political tactic of showing meant to evoke a disruption of the framing conditions of the drug war. If one's mindset is that addicts are something like enslaved and irresponsible beings, or consubstantially equivalent to a substance that renders them the evil internal enemy, then when the man sitting in front of you discussing drug, health, or judicial policy and legislation tells you that he is currently on heroin or was just using cocaine 12 hours ago, then your mindset will very likely be disturbed. In the midst of this disruption, this breakdown of the supposed to be, the politician, or whoever it may be, sees because she has been shown that an otherwise is possible. One can see, for example, that it is possible to use heroin every day for over 20 years and be, as the CNN author put it, both articulate and educated, without being either angry or in an alley. Of course, not all drug users look as good as Henrik, or as if they were on Wall Street like Martin, but it is important to note that not all non-users do either. I want to suggest, however, that although their look may make the effect more shocking, what is ultimately disruptive about this political tactic is the disclosed fact that active drug users are doing political activity well. Because of this, Henrik, Martin, Terrence, and all the other anti-drug war agonists I know are convinced that this form of disruptive politics works, whether people are initially fooled by how the user agonists look or not. For the point is not to show that drug users can fit into that which counts, but to change what counts. The point is to enact what Derrida has called democracy to come, or the regime of everyone beyond all exclusionary conditions. And this, as Terrence put it, is a matter of joining the battle and showing that rather than non-human evil, drug users are, in fact, leading the fight against exclusionary conditions. As he went on to tell me, quote, this drug user union will make a big difference if it's done correctly. People start coming forth and talking about People start coming forth and talking about themselves as users or as former users, and then make people know, like, wow, look at these guys right here. Look at this stuff they're doing. Going out talking to Congress, all these rallies, all these actions, and it's being brainstormed and organized by users. It's becoming effective. I think that is one of the most shocking things to our government officials, that these individuals that are using get this accomplished. They're no longer in the background. They're starting to come forth. They're starting to address issues. They're tired of the way we're being treated. You know what I'm saying? We're tired of being treated not second or third class, but ninth and tenth class, you know? We deserve to be treated like humans, just like anybody else. End quote. Here we see the double performative nature of this hermeneutically disruptive politics. For on the one hand, this form of politics performatively shows that drug users can, in fact, do politics, disrupting the frame that renders them less than human and irresponsible beings. They show that they are indeed capable of doing the most human of all activities, that is, political activity. While on the other hand, by means of this very enactment, they simultaneously transform the situated conditions into those by which they must count as human. For by actually doing politics themselves, drug users do not simply show that they are capable of it, but more importantly, they force others to recognize this capability by engaging in political activity with them, even if they are ultimately against them. This doubly performative transformation is what those who politically interact with anti-drug war agonists find to be the most shocking thing, for it disrupts the order of how things normally are. This transformative disruption, however, may only be temporary, as the conditions are not permanently changed by means of any singular political act. But the political wager is that over time, enough disruptions will lead to further acts that will have permanent worldly effects. This disruptive politics, then, has what Simon Critchley calls a clitoral logic, which he sees as the ethical and political moment in Derrida's thinking. Clitoral logic is that by which the limit that bounds or closes or conditions any situation is interrupted by that which exceeds that situation. This excess is not outside or beyond the situation, however, but an integral aspect of it. Thus, interruption, or what I am calling disruption, is possible because every situation is an open structure because of this disruptive potentiality, what Critchley calls a clause of non-closure within the situation itself. As one of the inclusively excluded grounds of the contemporary biopolitical order of things, drug users are this excess that are a disruptive source for a potential otherwise. The hermeneutic disruptive tactic of showing is how they politically enact this clitoral logic. Furthermore, in contrast to the assumption that political change comes about through rational conversation and debate, this hermeneutically disruptive political tactic begins with the postulate that changing biopolitical conditions is a matter of changing habits. This is a political tactic that appreciates that if it is the case, as William James put it, that habit is the enormous flywheel of society, its most precious conservative agent, then the first political task must be to disrupt and change habits so as to ultimately change society. Thus, the hermeneutic politics and the disclosive tactic of showing enacted by the anti-drug war movement recognizes that the drug war of culture, mindset, or ideology, or for that matter, what we normally call meaning, understanding, and interpretation, are not a consequence of the most rational argument or the realization of the truthfulness of one position over another. Rather, they are acquired and habituated ways of being, speaking, acting, and doing that are grounded in a particular rhetoric and style framed and given legitimacy not only by institutions of power, but perhaps more significantly, by the seeming sharedness of those around us. If this is the case, then, political change does not occur by making a better argument, but rather, as Wendy Chun puts it, political change and the otherwise come about by enacting habitual disruptions of the habitual, which makes possible experiencing the inexperienceable. It is precisely this experiencing the inexperienceable that anti-drug war agonists bring about when they show others that they are, in fact, exceptionally capable of exercising their humanness by being very adept political actors. Such habitual disruptions initiate not only personal, but ultimately socially and politically creative attempts to imagine and enact new habituated ways of being. It is by disrupting and changing habits, then, that anti-drug war agonists attempt to politically change the framing conditions of the drug war, and in so doing, attempt to invent new relations and futures. Building worlds of non-exclusion in the time of war. Ultimately, though, this is a long and slow political process. But within the conditions established by wars on people, it is unclear how else political and social change could come about. This is perhaps even more the case in an historical context in which military power, including that of militarized police, has surpassed any realistic hope of insurrection. That is, in a context in which revolution no longer seems a viable option, and liberal reformism is increasingly exposed as little more than a last-ditch effort to maintain an exhausted status quo, it seems that change can only begin to come about by such disruptive tactics to the conditioned and habituated supposed to be, by showing, for example, both the willing and unknowing perpetrators of the drug war that they live in a fantasy world, and how things could and should be otherwise, new habituated ways of being, indeed new worlds, slowly come into existence. In fact, it is just such tactics that are behind the recent victories of the anti-drug war movement in the United States, where medical and personal use marijuana are increasingly being legalized, one result of which is the decreasing numbers of low-level marijuana arrests that have contributed to both the rise of mass incarceration and the increasing precarity of those, mostly African-American and Latino young men, who have been arrested. Or in Copenhagen, where prescription heroin is now being implemented, which will increasingly lead to less crime related to street dealing and fewer overdoses as the result of users not knowing the purity of the heroin they buy on the street. Or in the downtown east side of Vancouver, where an entire neighborhood has been transformed into a world in which drug users are increasingly able to dwell because they no longer die at an average of about 300 per year in just one small neighborhood as they did a little over a decade ago. Each of these victories become possible because anti-drug war agonists began by disrupting the conditioned and habituated framing of addicts in the fantasy world produced by the drug war. The clearing these disruptions brought about, allowed for, made political space for, imagining new possibilities for how to live in worlds with drugs and drug users without the latter being that world's exclusionary ground. As a result, these anti-drug war victories have significantly bettered the lives not only of drug users, but non-drug users alike. Thus, for example, with reduced policing, decreases in crime, better relations between people within certain neighborhoods, and a reduction of infectious diseases, the otherwise that the anti-drug war movement hopes to bring about is one that will be better for all. Perhaps Martin put this best. All of this is for one goal, and that's making it better, for not just me, but for everyone. Not just for me, not just for users, but for everyone. In our contemporary condition of wars on people, then, the anti-drug war movement is showing us a model of political activity for fighting against the biopolitical inclusive exclusion of internal others. In so doing, they are also showing us how a world without exclusionary conditions, a world that is characterized by attuned care, could slowly come to be. Thank you.